From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sunnyvale, California.
Oakland, California.
Oakland, California.
North Oakland.
North Oakland.
North Berkeley.
South Berkeley.
Adams Point.
Yosemite.
Coming up, we look back at San Francisco students' activist struggle that started the country's first ethnic studies department.
Certain days I felt like God is kind of like a little bit of a war zone here.
Then we'll hear from the head of Stanford's Institute for Diversity in the Arts.
We're in a culturally desegregated world. Jay-Z and Beyonce are everywhere. And yet, at the same time, you could still have a Michael Brown, a Trayvon Martin.
And we get a lesson in an ancient language.
Ti shepeh mot entotk.
Ti shepeh mot entotk.
Perfect. That means thank you in Coptic.
Well, ti shepeh mot entotk. For listening to Cross Currents, stay with us. Last month, the San Francisco School Board unanimously agreed to expand ethnic studies courses to all San Francisco high schools starting next fall. About 90% of the district is made up of people of color. Courses on ethnic identity and race relations are currently being taught at 5 high schools as part of a pilot program initiated 6 years ago. District officials say the classes have improved the attendance and GPAs at those schools. The fight for a curriculum that reflects the nation's diversity actually began decades ago at San Francisco State University. In 1968, protesters called for the creation of an ethnic studies department. The protest was marked by violence, hundreds of arrests, months of disrupted classes, and dozens of faculty firings. KALW's Melanie Young takes us back to that historic time over 40 years ago.
Western street with eastern manners, tall pagodas and golden banners throw their shadows through the lantern glow.
As a little girl growing up in the 1950s, Dr. Lorene Chu spent her evenings watching exotic dancers and circus acts at her family's nightclub, the Chinese Sky Room. To outsiders, the club sold a fantasy of Chinatown as an alien land, much like that depicted in the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, Flower Drum Song.
Grant Avenue, San Francisco, California, USA. Looks down from Chinatown over a foggy bay.
But when Chu grew up and moved beyond Chinatown to attend San Francisco State University, it was her turn to drop into a kind of alien environment.
It was predominantly white. You know, I rarely saw faces of other groups on campus. I remember being very quiet.
Chu says several factors explain the low number of minorities at colleges then.
Getting a college education was really considered somewhat of a privilege for families at that point. You know, having a college education was very statusy and basically for more kind of elite thinking, although everybody wanted that for their kids. It's not necessarily something that everyone could afford.
But by the late 1960s, those factors were changing. An overhaul of immigration policy meant huge growth in the state's Asian and Latino populations, and perceptions of the role and right to a college education began to change.
There were very audacious times for those of us who were able to participate. We felt that we could change the world.
Sing, shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing.
You know, there was this incredible force that anything was possible if you only struggled and made it be known and fought for it.
And so the fight began for a more diverse campus and for a curriculum that included the history of minority communities in California. The push for ethnic studies meant more than satisfying academic curiosity. As minority populations began to grow, their needs became more complex. Student leaders believed ethnic studies would shed light on the contributions and needs of their communities and lead to better public policy. And Chu says the courses would enable minority students to better serve their communities themselves.
They will work in social services and the human services in the community, and then maybe moved out of it. But they never lost sight that they had a tie and also a responsibility to the community that for which by which we came from.
To be better prepared to serve their communities, student leaders believe they first had to upend the existing college system. So, a coalition of hundreds of students and faculty members staged a strike. For 5 months, most classes at San Francisco State were shut down, and the campus erupted in periodic violence, arrests, and faculty firings. It was the longest college strike in U.S. history.
You know, the campus was very disrupted, you know, and then also because there was a lot of damage to property, you know, it was not very pleasant to live on. You know, you had doors that were boarded up, windows that were boarded up, police everywhere. Certain days I felt like God is kind of like a little bit of a war zone here.
It was also a divided campus. Chu says many students didn't support the movement and dismissed anyone on strike as
troublemaker, militant, communist. In the larger frame of the PR, you know, we were seen as radicals and militants and people that needed to be taught a lesson if we were ever caught, and that they did.
Like hundreds of other students, Chu was swept up in mass arrests and spent 20 days in jail.
It was like they planned this military move or something, how to surround 500 or 470-some people, you know. So I saw my friend's head get bashed in, you know, bloody. I saw lots of people go down the floor because they were being hit by clubs and stuff. You know, to be honest, I was very scared because I had never, you know, been arrested, much less go to jail. My mom's going to kill me. That's what was going through my mind.
As Asian students, Chu says she and her friends faced special criticism.
That's the first time people heard that we had voice, and they're not going to like it, but they're going to say, well, they're copying the blacks, or they're copying all the derelicts of society. You know, oh, my God, you know, what are these people doing to these wonderful Chinese people who have always pulled themselves up by the bootstraps and overcome everything with racism, you know? Like we were being contaminated.
Despite the chaos, education at State did move forward, often in creative ways.
So many of us got very involved in organizing our community as part of our learning here. The spirit and the whole cohesiveness of what we were trying to achieve was very exciting.
By the end of 5 long months, the strikers and the administration negotiated an agreement. The administration agreed to establish a College of Ethnic Studies and open up admissions to encourage a diverse student body. Then, according to Chu, came the hard part.
Get it going, keep it alive, and then becoming credible to be accepted. It's like certain people didn't think that we would last for more than 5 or 6 years. That would be like, oh, they can't get it together. Who's going to teach ethnic studies? Who's trained?
Well, today, it's Dr. Chu.
Now, this whole, like, immigrants are taking over our jobs. Immigrants are
today,
everywhere.
Chu is giving a guest lecture to an Intro to Ethnic Studies course, one of well over 150 classes offered by the College of Ethnic Studies. Now, over 40 years after the strike, San Francisco State is among the most diverse universities in the country. Beyond the establishment of the college, Chu says the strike was enormously important on a personal level for her.
I actually feel very lucky that I was given that opportunity to go through that journey. You know, I think many of us see our lives work more clearly because of it.
In San Francisco, I'm Melanie Young for Cross Currents.
Laureen Chu is now the graduate coordinator for the Master of Arts program in Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State. You can find archival photos of the 1969 student protest at kalw.org and just click on Cross Currents. Despite Despite victories like ethnic studies, the current unrest after police shootings of unarmed black men mean the battle for racial justice is far from over. Jeff Chang is a journalist, cultural critic, and head of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford. In his new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America, he argues that the myth of multiculturalism has in some ways silenced a real conversation about racial disparity in America.
We're in a culturally desegregated world, right? Diddy's a superstar. Jay-Z and Beyonce are everywhere. Everybody agrees with me that they're amazing, you know? Well, maybe not everybody, but you know. And yet, at the same time, you can still have a Michael Brown, a Trayvon Martin, a Tamir Rice, and Eric Garner happen.
KALW's Sandhya Dirk sat down with Chang to talk about his new book, Current Protests Over Police Shootings, and how to begin a conversation about race in America today.
In so many ways, this is a book about sort of the myth of the post-racial world,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if in the current events that we're seeing right now, we're kind of watching that myth just come crashing down in a really real way.
It feels weird to even use the word post-racial. Like, certainly nobody believes that anymore. If there are any people who are hanging on to that notion, it's they have lost lost their grasp on that. And the post-racial notion, in some ways, was an updated version of, let's all be colorblind now. Everything's good now. It's all great. But now that we can see the gaps, not just between the ideal of colorblindness or the end of colorblindness, if it's not your ideal, and the reality, and even between where our president chooses to stand and where the protesters and demonstrators choose to stand, we could see the gaps opening up there. I think it's impossible for us not to come to a point of questioning. What I fear the most is that we move through this period and come to a new way of redefining colorblindness such that we have to deal with this again.
That we do it all over again.
In my children's generation, yeah. I mean, you know, look at like the race riots of the 60s. And we come back around to the race riots of the 80s, you know, 1992, the Los Angeles riots. And now this spate of, you know, police killings that show us that the ways in which we see race actually haven't necessarily changed that much.
One of the things I found so interesting about reading this was sort of the analysis that you did of pop culture, advertisement, sort of everything that surrounds us in terms of media and the way that it works to help perpetuate that sort of the post-racial myth over and over and over again, preventing us, in a sense, from ever actually confronting the lack of that.
Yeah, the book really is about artists and the way that they can literally change the way that we see. And I came in like really wanting to kind of express that. The kind of culmination of that is this sort of slogan that me and a lot of folks, for lack of a better word, kind of have come up with, which is that cultural change precedes political change. Like, if you can't see it in the culture, it's definitely not going to be happening up in Congress. And so, you know, you had to see Jackie Robinson on the baseball field before you can even imagine a Brown versus Board of Education decision. You had to see Ellen DeGeneres on TV before you can even imagine same-sex marriage being a thing.
If art is this key, how do we wield it to make it different for your children's generation?
Well, I think we wield it fiercely, and we continue to be really about looking at what is lacking and what we need to kind of reveal, right? And to give you some examples, let me give you some hard examples because we've been talking kind of abstractly.
I love hard examples.
Hard examples. So, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. goes up and gives this speech in Washington in 1963, March on Washington. He says all these things, and one of the things he says is we should be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. And it's this that the conservatives seize in the 1970s and the 1980s to say, let's talk about putting colorblindness into the law so that we can reverse all of these, you know, changes that have been made because of civil rights legislation that was passed, right? And so colorblindness in the 80s becomes a way of reacting against and tearing down this infrastructure of policies and laws that have been put into place to transform America. And so what you get is the ultimate outcome of it is Ward Connerly in California, you know, sponsoring an equal opportunity initiative that's designed to get rid of affirmative action in the state of California, that everybody should be treated equally under the law, including privileged whites. Whereas that was never the intention. That was exactly, it was actually the exact opposite. It was to remedy racial discrimination. So that, right? And then even with the notion of multiculturalism, it was a radical idea that Ishmael Reed kind of put into circulation with the word multiculture in 1975 in the Berkeley Barb. And it was meant to say that there are other ways of being in the U.S., other ways of becoming American that that don't involve having to assimilate into a white, suburban, sort of WASPy ideal. There are all these different types of ways, and we've always been a country of many, many cultures. It was a radical idea because at that time it was assumed that America can only be one kind of culture. It had to be a unitary type of thing. If you weren't going to assimilate, then the country was going to fall apart. And so it was a radical idea at the time. And I think what you see is by the time you get to the turn of the millennium, you know, and afterwards, George W. Bush is now appointing Alberto Gonzalez and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell in the name of diversity. And so multiculturalism now has sort of a culturally conservative analog. And that's as a way, again, of figuring out how to maintain the status quo, even if you've got to give out a couple of positions here. And every time there's a change, there's an equal pushback. And that's where the culture wars, I think, come from.
What are the things about race that we're still afraid to talk about?
We're afraid to talk about injustice, inequality, discrimination, and privilege, and not necessarily in that order, maybe even in reverse order. We're certainly like not anxious to start a conversation about our own privilege and what that entails, because that would require possibly us, definitely us, giving up some of that privilege, right?
And being implicated.
And being implicated in this, right? And, you know, that may shine a light on things that we don't want to examine. You know, the race conversation is something that's really interesting. At this particular point, right now, right in the middle of it all, we can't avoid it. But are we having the kinds of conversations and are people hearing and joining the conversations where they need to be? What we saw happening, I think, after Ferguson was that there were a number of polls that showed that there's not just a growing resegregation, racial resegregation in schools, in housing,
in income,
in wealth, in home ownership, in educational attainment, and all those kinds of things. There's also a gap in the way that we talk about this. So that, you know, the polls asked, is Ferguson opening up an opportunity for us to be able to talk about issues that need to be talked about around race? Blacks overwhelmingly said yes. Whites, not so much. They were on the other side of the spectrum. So the other side of the question was, are the events in Ferguson casting too much attention on race? And not a majority, but a plurality of whites, a large plurality of whites said yes. Like, we're talking about it too much. So we can't even, one group's invitation to join a conversation is another group's invitation to say, okay, see ya, I'm out the door. Can we even get into the same room around this? But we need to. We haven't had a consensus around racial justice since 1965. And that's why we've gone backwards on all these things. And that's why we have these repercussions and reproductions and sort of reverberations every generation of explosive moments that point to all of these wounds that haven't been healed. And so at this particular moment, I think that we need to engage in that particular conversation. We need to see people talking about disparities in policing, in incarceration, in containment. We need to be talking about resegregation. Gentrification is only part of resegregation. It's the part that you see in the city. So it's gotten a lot of attention because there's a lot of people in the city that can talk about gentrification. That's what's happening into their neighborhoods. But where do people go? That's the other part of it. That's the other part of resegregation. And
it's reverse white flight. I mean,
it's reverse white flight.
The greatest change in migration in American cities.
But what I'm saying is in this debate that we're having here in the San Francisco Bay Area around gentrification, we don't talk about the people who have been displaced, and we don't hear from the people who have been displaced. We're hearing from the people who are afraid of being displaced, who are a very important part of the discussion. But what about the people who have been displaced? And so what I'm saying is in order for us to have a true conversation about it, it needs to be a regional conversation about it. People are being forced into the aging suburbs, such as Ferguson, such as Sanford, where policing is really the only governmental service that's growing. And so let's talk about that.
That was Jeff Chang, head of Stanford's Institute for Diversity in the Arts, speaking with KALW's Sandhya Dirks. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News, I'm Hanat Baba. Our next story comes from our Spiritual Edge project, stories of belief, belonging, and practice.
I'm a Muslim.
I am Jewish.
I have no religion.
I'm Christian.
Reform Judaism.
I'm Catholic.
Muslim. Not religious.
Buddhist.
Southern Baptist.
Hindu. Atheist.
Christian.
Agnostic.
Catholic.
The holidays have wound down. The shopping and tinsel hubbub is done. Christmas is over, right? Well, not if you're a Coptic Christian. Copts are a small Orthodox Christian sect, and they follow an older calendar that celebrates Christmas today, January 7th. The majority of Coptic churches in the country are in California, and one of the oldest is nestled in the Hayward Hills, St. Antonius Coptic Church. Egyptian Coptic immigrants established it back in 1976. In the past decade, there's been an influx of Egyptian Copts fleeing discrimination and violence back home. Just as they're a minority in their homeland, they're a minority here too. So the church has become more than a place of worship. It's a crucial part of preserving the Coptic language and heritage as the immigrants raise new generations of American kids. I visited St. Antonius before Christmas to experience a day at a Coptic church. I walk in on a Sunday morning, and about 150 people are standing in prayer behind red velvet pews, men on one side, women on the other, some covering their heads with white lace scarves. All heads are bowed as the priest leads them in a hymn. They start in English, then they switch to Arabic, their spoken language back home in Egypt. And then a switch even further back. This is Coptic, the language spoken by Egyptians until the 7th century. It evolved from Greek and Demotic. Demotic goes back to 2000 BC and traces its roots to the Egyptian language of the Pharaonic era that was written in hieroglyphics. Head Deacon George Basilio says the language is a cornerstone of a heritage they're trying hard to preserve.
It's the very, very ancient language of the Egyptians. The Copts are those original inhabitants of Egypt that have used this language for many, many, many years before the conquest of the Arabs, and then now we've converted to the Arabic language as the language of the state.
Coptic is not really spoken today. It's now more of a liturgical language. And this is one of the few places in America you'd hear it. The ancient hymns echo off walls adorned in gold and red drapery with life-size paintings of Coptic saints, the Virgin Mary, and Jesus Christ. Altar servers stand chanting in the front of the room, facing one another in two lines, swaying while playing finger cymbals and tambourines. Meanwhile, the bishops wear white embellished robes and tall white papal head coverings with crosses. Bishop Bishoy Ray, the head of the church, addresses the congregation in interchangeable English and Arabic. Everyone here calls him Abuna, which means our father in Arabic.
Prepare yourself, Santa will come for your kids during maybe this week, at most the next week. I hope.
After receiving communion, everyone goes out to the hall for some coffee and cake. vegan cake because they are in days of fasting. For when they're not fasting, there's a little shop where they can buy Egyptian sausages and cheeses from back home. Sharing food is a big part of Coptic culture. Mary Allen has been coming here for 33 years and drives over every week from Redwood City. She hands me a round piece of bread about the size of my hand.
There is a special people in the church. They make it every week. They come the night before, and they pray on the bread, and it's ready in the morning for everybody.
I'm going to bite into it. So what significance does this have that I'm eating the bread?
You're getting blessed.
I'm getting blessed. Yeah. Today there are 450 families. A group of just 20 families started this Coptic community back in 1975. Back then, Bishop Ray says, things in Egypt were peaceful. Muslims and Christians lived side by side as neighbors. He recalls one day in college when he was over at a Muslim friend's house studying.
His mom knew that I'm fasting. So she started to do fasting, vegetarian food for me, especially for me, because I'm fasting. And while we're studying, he excused himself to pray, and I excused myself to pray or read in the Bible. So we're in very harmony, lovely.
But the recent influx of Copts is a sign of darker times. Following the ouster of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi in 2013, Coptic churches and homes were attacked by mobs. Bishop Ray says the violence is foreign to them.
It's very strange. It's not a nature of Egypt or Egyptian. It's something different. We heard about it in other countries, but in Egypt, never ever.
Over the past 3 years, he's seen his congregation more than double. Whole families emigrated, all gravitating towards this church. Kids of all ages came as English language learners, trying to fit in, including Pavli Farag, who emigrated with his family when he was 10. Now he's a well-spoken 16-year-old and says being a Coptic teen in America is challenging. Egypt is a conservatively cultured society, and Orthodox Copts are even more conservative than the mainstream. Drinking is frowned upon, even for adults. Much of the popular music is shunned as inappropriate, and no dating.
Temptations are pretty tough to deal with. It's not easy, and I have a lot of stuff to still work on, for sure, yeah.
And then there's the fasting. There are 210 days of fasting in a year. Like right now, as Farag observes the 43-day fast before Christmas.
So it's kind of hard to, like, when you go out with your friends, to abstain from, like, the dairy and all the dairy food and just stick to the fasting rules. So that I find that kind of tough at times.
So when Bishop Ray was given the choice of either growing the church into a cathedral or building a youth center, he recalled words from the church's highest priest in Egypt.
His Holiness Bob Shenouda always said, church without youth is a church without future.
So he opened a Coptic youth center, a place where the kids can socialize within the community. Today, about 50 kids in colorful tees and shorts are playing basketball in the center's gym.
My name is Philo Petir Serafim, and the best thing about coming to church, well, you pray for God and you just forgive him for all the bad things you did in your life.
His life of 9 years so far. There are other reasons to come to the church, he says.
You can just have fun with your friends, have a good time. It's really good. You should actually stay, actually.
And I do.
Nobody guarding, because we're not playing man-to-man. We said play man-to-man, okay? Deal? Let me guard someone. Tell me who you're guarding now, and then go.
I interrupt the huddle to talk with more of the kids.
My name's Andrew Abu-Sad. I like to come to church because I can pray and confess, and after that I like to play with my friends.
What do you confess to? What is there to confess to?
Sometimes, like when I say bad words and I get in fights, a bone of praise on you, and then that means you don't do it again.
Oh, and about Christmas? 11-year-old Brenna Banoub explains.
Ours is on January 7th.
So what do you do when everybody's celebrating on the 25th, but you're celebrating on the 7th?
Well, my family celebrate on both days. Like, we open our gifts on the 25th, but we come to church and have family over on the 7th.
So they get to have two Christmases. This is one of the things the church has decided to be flexible about. It's a necessary part of living in America, says Ismat Abdul Malik, one of the founders of the church.
The more the merrier. We celebrate the birth of our Lord twice. As long as you're remembering the reason for the season, that's what counts.
I leave the kids to their game, the parents to their Sunday afternoon mingling. But before I leave, I ask Deacon Basilios for a quick language lesson in Coptic to do my part in preserving this ancient language.
I can teach you maybe a sentence that says, O King of Peace, grant us your peace, establish upon us your peace, and forgive us our sins.
Oh no, that's long.
That's long, okay. I can teach you to say thank you.
Okay.
How is that?
Thank you is perfect.
Thank you is perfect. Ti shepehmot entotk.
Ti shepehmotk entotk.
Perfect. That means thank you in Coptic. Ti shepehmot entotk.
Ti shepehmot entotk.
Perfect.
All of that is just thank you?
Yes. That's too much. Yeah, but that's you just spoke Coptic. That's
Yay,
Coptic. Yes.
You can do your part in preserving the language, too. We have a link to a lesson in Coptic language at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. That's also where you can find more stories from the spiritual edge. Nofrishai empihin misi empi Christos. Merry Christmas. You've heard from us. Now we'd love to hear from you. Email us at news@kalw.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW, or call us 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Olivia Cueva, Lila Day, Sandhya Dirks, Rachel Dornhelm, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Christina Loring, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, and Liza Veal. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer was Audrey Dilling. The managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll investigate the true cost of seafood.
You like to have local people flourish. I mean, that's the name of the game. And if you look for price, then go to Walmart and get your fish from wherever they get it.
We're going fishing tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News. This music is by San Francisco's Luke Sweeney. You can hear more of him tomorrow night at the Brick and Mortar Music Hall in San Francisco. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.